Good afternoon, and welcome to the best panel of the day, because it's about Mormon women writers. And as far as I'm concerned, when you see the Mormon mind and the theme and the focus of this conference, raise your hand if you think in masculine terms about what the Mormon mind represents. There's no shame in that. We're conditioned to. So I hope that the authors today, as you get to hear their individual stories, and folks like Signature Books and Sunstone invest in those stories, that what we think of when we think of the Mormon mind is going to be expanded, and we'll carry that forward. I don't have you guys in order, so I'm just going to read their bios. So in our audience today, we have one of the authors, Erica Bell. Ball, do you want to stand up and say hi?
Stand up, Erica.
Yeah. She's a baby. That's unkind. Erica Ball graduated with a BS in mathematics and MS in statistics at BYU and has since worked in academia and industry, teaching at Indiana University and participating in the business analytics group at PricewaterhouseCoopers. She recently returned to Brigham Young University to teach and work on statistical methods that can predict curves over time, one application of which involves an analysis of light emissions from exploding supernova. Is it Nova or Novi? She is about to begin a PhD at Duke, and she loves to cook, enjoys Zumba, and plays the piano and organ. I think it's a lovely synopsis of someone who has a lot going on. Next we have Rachel Brown. Rachel? Rachel has BSW and MSW degrees and is a certified social worker and clinical therapist at the Family Support and Treatment Center in Utah Valley. She enjoys leading support groups and healing circles, playing with her three children, having late-night existential conversations with her partner, and writing an angst-filled memoir. She served an LDS mission in Houston, Texas. Welcome, Rachel. Ms. Langford? No? Are you Mercy?
I'm Mercy.
This is Camille. Camille's next to me.
You can see that I don't have them ordered. Camille Fairbanks never figured out what she wanted to do in life, but liked English classes well enough to complete a BA in English at the University of Lethbridge. She was then hired as the marketing manager for an automotive dealership, which she says was about as random as a career choice as it sounds. She was born in Mesa, Arizona. She and her husband moved to Canada in 2007, where they remain. At the time of this book's release, the son she writes about in her essay has grown to be 2 years old. She has an online site, Archives of Our Lives, archiveslives.com, where she writes about her work, marriage, and life as a recovering Diet Dr. Pepper addict. I know she's alone in that. Ms. Langford? Sylvia Langford still thinks of herself as a convert to the LDS Church, even though she has been a member for 28 years now. And she's the current Ward Relief Society president. Ms. Langford earned a degree in business and then went to work for the federal government to facilitate Freedom of Information requests. Her main passion, besides religion, continues to be music. I think you said that was your first calling. Did they put you in as a chorister?
Yes.
That's very helpful. Because as someone who was not raised Mormon, I can tell you that you sing at a totally different and slower pace than the rest of the world. She has studied both piano and voice and enjoys singing in the Mormon Choir of Washington, D.C. Okay. Marcy?
Yes.
All right. Nailed it. Marcy Monroe has always loved literature, which fueled her pursuit of a BA in creative writing at BYU and MA from the University of Texas, Austin, in rhetoric and composition. She's developed a brand of word art, which she and her sister market through an online business, Jabberdashery Custom Inspirational Art. I practice that. She has taught college classes in writing. She's also taught art, music, and theater to children, and currently homeschools four enthusiastic, clever, and kind children, her own, while she and her husband think about starting a school of their own. Bless you. Right. Ashley Mae Hoyland received a BFA in Studio Arts and an MFA in Creative Writing, both from BYU, and most of you have probably seen her artwork. She's since written and illustrated several children's books, founded a project to get local poetry onto Utah billboards, woot, woot, and started the WeBraveWomen.com campaign to publicize women of courage. She lives in Palo Alto with her husband and two small children, Remy and Thea, while her husband pursues a doctorate in geology at Stanford. She has a website, Ashmay, with lots more of her artwork and causes. And last, and certainly not least, is the editor and author of one of the essays. Jamie served an LDS Spanish-speaking mission in Toronto, then earned a BA in English from BYU. After 6 years of working as a science editor for Atomian Culture, a nonprofit organization that publishes science news in Europe, she received an MFA in writing and literature from Bennington College in Vermont. Besides writing her first novel, she's enjoying playing racquetball, reading astronomy books with her son, and being married to a U.S. Foreign Service officer. While she and her family are in Nicaragua over the next few years, she will communicate with readers of Fresh Courage Take through her personal website and social media. And if you've already read the book and you think that Jamie sounds maybe a little bit like Giselle in your imagination, you are not alone. That sounds like a lot to me. So we're gonna, the structure is each of our panelists will speak for about 10 minutes, and then we wanna leave a lot of the time at the end for questions, and then to meet the folks over at Signature Books in this throughway here, so that everyone can get a book, have it signed, and have time to do that before the next panel. And one of the great things about an anthology of this kind is that it's beginning a conversation. And here at Sunstone, we are so lucky because instead of having that conversation be over the internet or, you know, passed along in your book club, this is your opportunity to ask the women who wrote these incredible essays the questions that you want answered and begin the conversation today. So. Oh, is there any comment?
Thanks, Sarah. Make sure to talk about it for you. And thank you for coming. It is so wonderful to be here. I'm delighted to have most of our quorum from Fresh Courage Take here. It's quite the miracle to have this many of us in the same place, actually, not just because we span a spectrum of belief and circumstance, but also because we've got essayists living in Jerusalem, Alberta, Oman, California, the DC area, Indiana, and Colorado, as well as Utah. We started this project in 2012, finished it in November, and Colleen Whitley delivered the physical manuscript to Signature in December while I was still living in the Marshall Islands. From the beginning of this project to the time of its publication, just in the last 3 years, a lot of notable and interesting things have happened for women in the church. This is not a comprehensive list, but I wanted to provide some context for our session and mention some of what we witnessed after we wrote our first drafts. So, starting in June 2012, the Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast began. The Young Mormon Feminists group was founded. Nyland McBain gave a talk at the Fair Mormon Conference acknowledging the psychological pain some Mormon women feel at church. And a few months later, the age of eligibility for young women serving missions dropped from 21 to 19. Then came the Facebook group All Enlisted and the first Wear Pants to Church Day and the Let Women Pray movements. Then Ordained Women was founded along with MormonFeminists.org. Claudia Bushman and Carolyn Klein published Mormon Women Have Their Say. And in April 2013, sister missionaries were invited to join mission leadership councils, and Jean A. Stevens became the first woman to pray during General Conference. Then, Sherry Dew published Women in the Priesthood, and the church released two online essays, Race in the Priesthood and Plural Marriage and Families in Early Utah. Next, in January of 2014, Lindsay Hansen Park started her Year of Polygamy podcast with feminist Mormon housewives. And in March, portraits of the church's top female leaders were displayed in the conference center for the first time. Sister Ofa Kaufusi was the first woman of color to pray in the women's meeting. The Mormon Women's Stand Group was organized. Female leaders were included for the first time in the centerfold of the Enzyme, and Kate Kelly was excommunicated in June 2014. In August, Nylan McBain's book Women at Church was published, and Dora Mkabela from South Africa was appointed to the General Young Women's Board, along with women from Brazil, Japan, and Peru. And she was the first woman of color to pray at a session of General Conference, because the church confirmed that the General Women's Meeting is now an official session of conference. In October 2014, the church released two more online essays called Plural Marriage in Kirtland and Nauvoo, and The Manifesto and the End of Plural Marriage. And in March 2015, the Feminist Mormon Women of Color blog began, and the Utah Senate passed legislation to ban discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity with exemptions for religious organizations. This bill was backed by the church, and earlier this month, the church made a first-time donation to the Utah Pride Center Youth Program for LGBTQ youth. And now Signature has published Fresh Courage Take, New Directions by Mormon Women. But it doesn't stop here. This year alone, we will have two other books, Voices for Equality and Mormon Feminism, Essential Writings. What I see going on here is a wonderful and needed conversation. And our book is part of this larger discussion about gender expectations in religious communities. Fresh Courage Take represents unification despite difference and the celebration of difference among Mormon women. As Robin Morgan, co-founder of the Women's Media Center nonprofit group, said, I call it feminisms, plural. The pomegranate is symbolic all over the world and across time. You'll see it on the cover of the book. It represents new life, a new start, love, marriage, fertility, health, royalty, ambition, prosperity, invincibility, and even mental maturity and the discernment and responsibilities that come with it. Sandro Botticelli and Leonardo da Vinci painted pomegranates into the hands of the Virgin Mary and the baby Jesus, representing the fullness of Jesus' suffering and resurrection. The Quran uses the pomegranate as an example of the good things Allah creates. In Turkey, they smash pomegranates at the beginning of the new year for good luck. I see this diversity and symbolism across culture and time as a representation of the many directions women can take according to their desires, their situations, and their beliefs. It's not limited to love, marriage, and fertility, although those can also be a celebrated part of one's path. Many Jewish scholars hold that the pomegranate was the original forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden, which adds extra meaning for us. It is knowledge that a woman must reach for. What I love most about the Eve and Adam story is that Eve directly and deliberately disobeyed God and her husband. And in our theology, that was a good thing. Tad Collister was my mission president in Toronto, and he used to tell us in Zone Conference that when Eve and Adam lived in the garden, it was like they were in a car in neutral gear, and Eve was the one who shifted gears to bring on mortality, progression, and joy. I know a lot of women who feel like they are spinning their wheels, like they are stuck. I have felt this way myself. My essay, Giselle, talks about how my mind got stuck on this ideal of perfection, and I named her Giselle. I created this woman in my mind, the woman I was supposed to be, in order to be good and to be loved, and she ended up being a false god. I was worshiping a cultural and doctrinal ideal, which in the essay I call idolatry. For me, it was very helpful to examine my experiences of Mormon women and see which assumptions were making me unhappy and anxious and obsessive and super judgmental of all other women. Octavius Caesar in Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra says to Cleopatra, "Make not your thoughts your prisons." The process of stepping back and thinking about my thinking helped me break out of my own prison and escape from Giselle's tight hold on my life. Along those same lines, I'd like to talk about ideology as idle. Ideology is a system of ideas and ideals that are characteristic of a group or an individual. At BYU, I became obsessed with Althusserian theory, critical theory. Louis Althusser was a 20th century French philosopher, and I found some of his theories on ideology helpful for me to distinguish between good and evil social pressures. Althusser says that ideology represents the imaginary relationship of individuals to their real conditions of existence. That is, ideology does not reflect the real world. And when we put a construction ahead of reality, when what we think we should be becomes more important than what we actually are, we become a slave to that construction. In the Marshall Islands, I ran into ideologies that clashed with my own. How the Marshallese thought about families was totally foreign to me. Children are largely fungible in extensive family networks and clans. An aunt means as much as a mother. The first week we were there, a woman offered her child to us in the grocery store because she knew that as ripelle, the people of the clothes, we would have the resources to support that child. The nuclear family of America is similarly foreign to them, and more than a little ironic since our families nuked their families during our military tests in the 1950s. A second ideology clash was when I tried to teach the young women in my Marshallese ward about appropriate Sunday behavior. But talking to them about not buying food on Sunday from local manuya shops when many of them didn't have refrigerators or pantry shelves full of food seemed ignorant at best and heartless at worst. The culture of the gospel is still infused with Western ideology. Althusser goes on to talk about hailing in his theories about ideology. He gives the example of a police officer on the street yelling, "Hey, you there!" And when that person turns around at the hail, he or she then becomes subject to the police officer. In my own life, while I love being the mother of my 5-year-old, I chose before he was even born to be called Jamie instead of Mom. For me, the title Mom was a hail. It was heavily imbued with my own ideology and my ideal as the perfect Mormon mother, and I didn't want this one role to usurp my entire identity. I remember I was pregnant and hiking in the Adirondacks with my husband when I decided this, and we talked all up the mountain about Althusserian hails, and he fully supported my decision. So my son has always called me Jamie, and to this day it brings me a lot of joy. It was my way of maintaining myself, of rejecting the hail of an ideology that was hurting me. Every woman and her set of ideologies is different, so I'm definitely not prescribing this. But for me, it was a relief to recognize that an ideal becomes an idol when it is something we no longer strive for, but become bound to. And we have to free ourselves and reject the hail. I sincerely hope that you enjoy reading Fresh Courage Take, and we'd love to know your thoughts on it via Amazon reviews, or by email, or by Facebook, or Twitter, hashtag Fresh Courage Take. It's meant to start conversations and build bridges and heal wounds. One of our essayists, Carly Anderson, was my Hebrew teacher at BYU, and although she couldn't come tonight because she was in Jerusalem, she and I had a midrashy conversation about pomegranates. The word for pomegranate in Hebrew is limon, and some scholars have concluded that it's related to the words that mean to rise up, to exalt, to uplift. And that is what we hope our book will do for you.
Okay, thank you so much, Jamie. And what an honor and delight it is to be here. I'm just It's been a wonderful experience since I was asked to write the essay to work with these women. And I've actually, most of us have not seen each other since our freshman year of college, which was like 12 years ago. It was a long time ago. So it's so wonderful that we somehow came back together in this way. Okay, and this is my essay. In the years since our road trip through Norway with my husband and two small children, a moment so brief, I almost wondered if it really happened, comes floating back to me often. It was early morning and we were driving on the high plains beyond the fjords. The lighting was hazy and pink, as if the sun knew it hadn't had a proper rest, and I felt much the same way. I looked up and out the window at one point, just in time to see two moose with heads bent to the ground. The morning fog tucked softly around them. Their largeness, otherworldliness, and serenity shocked me. The image passed too quickly to even form words to tell my husband, but still, I cannot shake it. I've wondered why the memory, even at the time, felt so significant, except that I knew my accompanying emotion at the time was panic. Internal panic at what I perceived to be the pinnacle of a spiritual crisis, a crisis of faith. Earlier that day, staring into the thick, wise turquoise water of the fjords, I had felt so small, so rough and lazy in my knowledge, and so presumptuous in truly believing that I knew much of anything. I felt anxiety over feeling trapped in the gospel I had once felt entirely comfortable in. I pulled over and asked my husband to drive. The expansiveness and beauty of the world I was experiencing could not equate to me saying that I knew anything about anything for sure, let alone the truths and solved mysteries I believe the doctrines of the church were asking me to claim. When I think back to that week in the backcountry of Norway, my heart jumps across a chasm of two different camps, one of complete awe and joy at the world around me, and one a culminating and complete crisis of faith. In the time since, though, I've also asked myself this: what if it weren't a crisis? What if I had merely chosen different language to sculpt my experience? Would the chasm have lessened? Would I realize that both camps were actually not so different? What if we entered the inevitable time when we must take our faith out of the pack on our back to really examine it, as if it were just that, an examination, a curiosity, a responsibility, a hope to better understand? In poetry, at least good poetry, each word that stands guard like a soldier to wiser thought is carefully recruited. A superfluous, or worse yet, an ill-chosen word can be the hinge that sends the reader right out of the poem. The poet is responsible for etymologies, context, sounds, cadences, and ancestries of each word used. Words carry weight and baggage, and the poet cannot ask the reader to simply brush those aside. In a similar way, we are the poets of our own spirituality, and we must take accountability for phrases like crisis of faith. It seems that often we wave the phrase crisis of faith like a flag of bravery or martyrdom. We use it as a demarcation between those who are thinking and those who are following blindly. We tout it under our belts as if it were an event that came and went, and either we stayed in the church or we left. I want to propose that our language can dictate a more positive experience for us, whether we choose to stay in the church or not. What if we simply put some phrases given to us to rest? What if we took greater responsibility for our language and cast aside some phrases that have simply been passed on to us? What if we refused to note some of our most real and mature spiritual thinking as a crisis and instead gave it a phrase that moved us from victimhood to powerful players in our own spiritual journeys? Take a moment, just as a test, to rename your crisis of faith. And I'll give you just a minute to maybe think of a new phrase, whether you've had a crisis of faith or not. And probably at some point, I'll know. I've done some experimenting with alternative phrases to crisis of faith, just to see how it does change experience. In an art show, I asked people to come up with their own phrase and write them on the wall next to a big giant banner that said crisis of faith. I also provided a list of words from the New Testament that they could use as prompts because, as it turns out, Christ, even in scenarios that legitimately could be classified as crises, never used the term. Here are some of the phrases that people came up with. Wonderful wilderness, questioning to gain knowledge, hidden growth, looking for better feelings, seeking more light, rest hot heart be full, finding new shores, journey for truth, standing in motion, looking higher, learning who we really are, opportunity to build a more genuine relationship with God, teaching out of love. These are valuable phrases to me because they set me up to be a seeker, a searcher, and a climber. They are phrases that dictate to me change without fear, searching without guilt, and genuine love between myself and deity. There is something about a crisis that puts one in a rather helpless place. A crisis might be an earthquake or a disaster in which the one experiencing crisis is also, by default, the victim of circumstances beyond their control. A crisis puts one into fight or flight mode because survival is the main objective. In crisis, there is little time or even reason to stop and meditate, be thoughtful, or pray. For me, when I think of my questions in the gospel as a crisis of faith, I am set at odds with God, almost as if he's the one who created the disaster I am fighting to get free from. There were times when I became the victim of my spirituality rather than the explorer. When I feel at most in the midst of a spiritual crisis, when I'm tired of wrestling my thoughts, I become quiet. When I allow myself the liberty to think beyond the phrase crisis, I realize that I am not at odds with God, but rather my searching can be cause for beautiful communion. When I am in crisis mode, I am stuck in a valley scrambling for understanding, but what I would rather be is an explorer setting out for greater heights and views. And I realize that often I am the only one that can choose which place I will be in. About 10 years ago, after my mission, there was a metaphorical set of doors that I had opened slowly in my spiritual life. And inside those doors, everything felt turned upside down. My spiritual life was swept up in the whirlwind of thousands of words I read on the internet, long nights of discussions with friends, and a lot of internal strife. Inside this space, my spiritual life did feel like a crisis because I couldn't gain traction. There was little to grasp onto by way of definite truth or certain understanding. For a few years, I stayed inside these walls, with colored wires running every which way, some of them sparking at the ends, and me feeling a little panicked at how to organize these wires into something functional. Throughout those 10 years, I've hardly missed a Sunday, and have continued to find much peace and joy in the gospel. But the thing I never considered was that my two experiences, my crisis and my faith, could be intertwined to the extent that they were both pushing me on to the same higher planes. There was also something exhilarating about the space of chaos for a time, something exciting about saying that I am the one who is different, I am the one who is brighter for my questions. At a certain point, though, being inside those walls was not sustainable. I had children, a husband, work to do, and I needed energy. Feeling like I was in a crisis was no longer an option. I saw another set of doors, not the same set I had come through originally, but a set that led me out of this place of chaos. A set built upon the idea that what I was experiencing did not have to be a crisis and did not actually put me at odds with God. I had to make a choice. I made it several times. I decided for a time to leave the crisis behind. Not that I was without question, and nothing got put on the shelf, but I had to make a question to redefine my spiritual journey. It couldn't be a crisis anymore. These new doors took some humbling to push open and walk out into the other side. But what I found when they were open was a beautiful meadow singing with possibility. Expansive space that suggested to me that my spirituality was not confined to a set of rules or expectations, but rather my spirituality and even my attempted spirituality is sacred, holy, and cherished by God. The meadow offered to me exploration and possibility. In this place, I was shed of faith, phrase crisis of faith, because my questions no longer seemed like a crisis. My confusion at church doctrine or church history seemed pale in comparison with what lay in front of me. I am learning to turn chaos into my own kind of order, which seems like the most godlike quality I can attempt for now. I am using words like learning, experimenting, exploration, faith, compassion, journey, trust, and love as vanguards in my spiritual wanderings. I'm still an active Mormon, and while there are times that that phrase begins to creep to cynicism, panic, or even anger, there are more times when I'm so grateful for a context to help me see heavenly parents and spiritual enlightenment. The word crisis is no longer allowed as part of my spiritual vocabulary because, while it may have served me for a time, I cannot climb to higher peaks with it atop my shoulders. As I thought back to the peaceful set of moose standing silent and sacred up in the wilderness of Norway, I think I've come to better understand the reason they come back to me so often. At the time, I saw in them something I so wanted for myself, an unaffected confidence at their place in the world. I envied their simplicity. I wanted to stand with grace and assurance in my place. The spiritual turmoil I felt at the time would not allow me that kind of peace or confidence. For a time, I thought it meant I must leave the church, and at some point it might. But I think over the past year, those serene and peaceful moves have become a symbol of what I might become within the church. A beloved creature, not at odds with God, but cared for deeply. A creature not in crisis, but one standing peacefully, eager for what the rising day might bring.
I was all worried about standing up. That was just really beautiful, really, really beautiful. My name is Marcy Monroe, and I did have visuals, but I only put them in this morning, and they're really not that cool because y'all have really good imaginations. So here we go. I want you to think you're driving down I-50. Yes?
Can you make sure your mouth is very close to the microphone? We're having a hard time hearing.
How's that? Yeah? I can be loud. Okay. Imagine you're driving down I-15 corridor, like say from Brigham City past Orem, and if you're like me, I get this shock every time I drive down because there are so many darn billboards, and my eye is like a little child that can almost not read them. And I've done this before, I didn't do it this time because it's depressing, but I always notice whenever I come into Utah how many billboards there are about changing your physical appearance. And it deeply, deeply bothers me. So imagine one of those, because there's like a million, that you might have seen. And I want you to think about who the market is for that billboard and what a woman like that might have in common with someone who seeks ordination to the priesthood or something else similar. Okay? And just keep that in mind as I talk, and hopefully that makes sense. Does that seem like a contradiction to you? Do we maybe put different people's struggles in different levels of boxes? I don't know about that. I've had a lot of contradictions in my life, and I have never really had a huge problem bringing them to my knees. I mean, they've always kind of been fun, for the most part. But I want to talk a little bit about... I wanted to mention the contradiction that I kind of struggle with in my essay, and then I wanted to move on to the one that I didn't talk about that's also equally important to me. To quote myself from the book, "For years I struggled with the age-old contradiction most evident, I thought, in the counsel LDS leaders were giving to young women to prepare for a career, but to be prepared to give it up. On the one hand, my future felt limited by my marriage prospects, and eventually my body's ability to bear children, both factors out of my control. Yet it seemed unfair to give my mind, my time, heart, and money to something I might never use. And then later, for centuries, women were considered inferior, even as they were told to act as if mothering was near to divinity." When I wrote this essay, I can't remember if I started before I had the baby or right after, but I was very sleep deprived and I was very high on hormones. And in my mind, the only way that I could even begin to write such a thing was to frame it as a letter to my daughters, which ended up causing problems later on because I was like, "Daughters, you should do this." And the other readers were like, "You can't tell people what to do." And I was like, "Oh, right, yeah." I mean, I was just, okay. I was really talking to myself. Anyway, in the essay, I briefly mention another struggle that I had. The one I mention is struggling, again, with what is my role beyond the mother in college and beyond. And at around the same time, I was also struggling with something else. And it parallels my discoveries discussed there. And so today I want to kind of frame, and this is, again, 5 months after another baby, so not quite as many hormones, but I wanted to frame it as maybe a message to my nieces who one of them is here today, and who were like my first daughters, and I love them dearly, and I want to talk about bodyhood. I hit my major growth spurt when I was in sixth grade. Womanhood came early and in a big way, and at the beginning of junior high, I could share clothes with my sister, who was almost 6 years older than me and was a junior, I believe. I could be wrong about the exact numbers there. And we shared shoes and we shared bras. And within a few months, all my new school clothes were now hand-me-ups to my older sister because they didn't fit in any way. And this, you know, normal awkwardness of a tween somehow, at some point along the way, turned into body dysmorphic disorder, which is similar to what someone who has anorexia might see, where you actually, in your mind, you see something different when you look at a mirror or at a picture. And I was completely oblivious to it. So ironically, one of my, I have a lot of health bloggers that I read, but one of my favorites, she's a doctor named Aviva Rom, sent an email out the other day, which was perfect, so I'm going to read what she said. Did you know that on average, women have at least one negative body thought every waking hour of the day? Many of us have 35, 50, or even 100 self-hating thoughts each day. Having an I hate my body thought at least one each day is one of the most common threads we share as women. This is according to her. And we tolerate telling ourselves that we think what we would think was offensive should someone not say it. So what I guess I didn't write was about the healing that I had to do to be able to move forward in my life. And ironically, or maybe not ironically, it started my sophomore year of college. I was a theater major at Utah State at the time, and I'd been cast in the musical A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which is an awesome musical, and I was a courtesan named Vibrata. And it was the hardest role I've ever had to play, at least emotionally, because I was supposed to act desirable, and not just in like the, you know, she doesn't know she's beautiful kind of way, but in the like owning it kind of way, and I was not comfortable owning such a thing. In my very damaged body, that was very, very hard. And my first fitting, I wore my skimpy, really was not skimpy, but it felt so skimpy to me. I didn't have sleeves, and you could see my belly button, and I sobbed. I literally sobbed, and I was so embarrassed because I was trying to be a big girl about it and not be all like diva, and anyway. I felt horrible for the costume designer who was a dear friend, I didn't know what was going on at the time, obviously, but looking back. Luckily, at the same time, I was also taking a life-changing English class, which I mentioned in the book because it was that awesome, from a woman that I will be forever indebted to, and I was discovering feminism. In that class, and through independent guided reading from this professor, I learned about the gaze. Okay. It was this concept that just absolutely burned my brain into awesomeness, and I loved it, and it was so freeing to me. I'm going to share John Berger's in his book Way of Seeing how he describes that, and hopefully it's hard to know how much to define for you, but men look at women watch themselves being looked at. This determines not only most relations between men and women, but also the relation of women to themselves. So the gaze comes from a film term, and you can imagine whoever's holding the camera is like the gazer, right? And in the 70s, the point of view was always being shot as female, and so when there was a woman, you know, it tried to mimic what a man would do looking at a beautiful woman. But it has become so invasive that as me as a teen, it was internalized into me, and so I looked at myself with this gaze, which is a problem because I'm not a male, I'm not attracted to women, among other things, and I don't desire women, and they're... And then just the whole problem of beauty in our culture is pretty hard to unravel from the gaze, from sexualization and from objectification. But with this knowledge, I started to see myself and started to see the pressure to be beautiful for what it really was. And I was really empowered by this intellectual understanding. Now going back to the show, what was really interesting and also really a huge blessing was that my awesome costume designer had this great idea to run amok with the idea of desirability and sexualization, and to make us courtesans these beyond caricatures in ridiculousness, okay? So she chose some of the just laughable sex symbols of kitty cat, nurse, you know, hello nurse, cheerleader, and I was the Viking princess. And she designed our costumes in such a way so that when we were up on stage, the whole point was not at all for us to get a desirable response, it was to be laughed at. And ironically, I was totally fine with being laughed at on stage. I was much more comfortable with that than being attractive, ironically. So anyway, I was no longer an object of sexuality on the stage. It was just very strange. I don't even know how to talk about it, really. But it kind of exposed the farce for me that was the gaze. So I had a picture. Sorry, I see it. But I had a whip, and I had really big horns in a few places. And it was fun. And I strut my stuff, and I whipped my whip, and it was a good moment for me. And even though that was a phenomenal start, it was only one piece of my healing journey, which I don't have time to lay out to now, but I want to go back to Come, Come, Ye Saints, which is what the book title comes from, to the phrases before it, gird up your loins, right? So from Ephesians, we gird up our loins with truth. Did anybody know, I had a picture of this too, how many of you know what girding looks like, right? So they had these big long togas. I know, because you sent me the Facebook picture, the thing on Facebook. Anyway, they pull up their togas through their legs, right, and wrap it around. And the whole point is because a toga or a maxi skirt is impossible to do anything in, right? It's a little bit of a... Anyway. So being girded is a ready and a working position. It keeps you unencumbered from our necessary worldly coverings, our clothes, and allows you to do what you need without being hindered by trivial things. It keeps you from tripping. So what does truth do for us? All those same things. It frees us and protects us from the devil's lies. It allows us to do what we need to without tripping. It guides us knowing who we are and where we are going. And it comes from God and the scriptures and revelation as well as other sources. So I had this problem where I couldn't see what was right in front of me. I couldn't truly see. I didn't even know it. And I knew that I had a poor body image. And I knew I was self-conscious, obviously. And I just thought I should lose weight. So a few years later, after my triumphal whipping on the Utah State stage, I had come to a point where I was just over having so much of my energy being sucked away by this body problem. And I decided to take a semester off school, and I took a break from the culture that seemed to intensify my feelings. And I attacked it full on. I did a number of different things, called it my body project. But one of the most powerful things that I did in those 4 months that I want to share with you, besides praying and studying, had to do with the mirror. It was an idea I got from this really silly book on self-esteem, but apparently wasn't so silly. It said that you couldn't truly love something if you didn't truly know and fully accept it for what it was. It suggested looking in a mirror without clothing for just 2 minutes and not breaking eye contact. So every day, do it every day. And sorry, I lost my spot. And while looking, you were supposed to say something like, "I accept what truly is," right, or something like that. So I had to work up to the 2 minutes. I had to work up to 2 seconds, to be honest. About not breaking the eye contact, and I was shocked with the storm of emotions that surfaced in the beginning of this exercise. It almost felt like some sort of New Testament devil spirit was gnashing its teeth inside me before it was going to be cast out. Eventually, I could look at myself calmly, without judgment, and it is one of the most empowering things I have ever done, and it continues to empower me and protect me in this world we live in as I drive down the I-15 corridor and see those billboards. So in this state that's responsible for the highest numbers of web searches for breast augmentation, and in a city that in 2007 Forbes named Salt Lake as the most vain city of the U.S., I want to come back to our intro question. First, I forgot I was going to tell this quick story. I tried to replicate this experiment just briefly with my young women a year or two ago. We were doing an activity on the body, and we did some yoga, and we were just having fun. And then at the end, I got all tricksy on them, and I pulled out that mirror. And I made them look in the mirror as I walked around the room. Of all the leaders who were there, so there were 5 leaders, and I think 21 girls, of all of those people, only one was able to look at herself without breaking eye contact. And this was for like 4 or 5 seconds was all I did, just like this, and moved on. The sight of themselves in the mirror was so uncomfortable that they could not look. So what might a woman that seeks ordination in the priesthood and a woman that is persuaded by these billboards have in common? There are many things we could answer this and consider, and one is that maybe they both want more, but if we turn that around, I think it's more true and more provocative. I feel like they are both missing something, or maybe they both feel a sense of loss. Brothers and sisters, the Mormon mind is for many of us out of balance as it has the gaze intruding and morphing what it sees. And to repeat John Berger that I mentioned earlier, men look at women, women watch themselves being looked at. This determines not only most relations between men and women, but also the relation of women to themselves. And what do women do to themselves? We have some ideas. But I'd like to close with Dr. Ramson's inspiring words. As women, we too often squelch ourselves, our big dreams and aspirations, in order to not appear too, what, too smart, too successful, too threatening, more economically empowered than the men in our lives, to not appear to anything. We lack confidence because of childhood, adult, and media messages we've internalized. We're afraid to brag because it might make us look arrogant, conceited. We play small. We forget to celebrate our wins. But sisters, the world needs us to take ownership of our bigness, to show up, to speak out, to be proud of ourselves, and to declare it. We are outstanding. Look at all we do as healers, teachers, scientists, farmers, artists, the million things we do to keep this world working, as moms, friends, wives, daughters. We have a right to shout our confidence from the rooftops, empowered, embodied, whole. Thank you.
Imagine you are walking down a long path. It is dark and foggy.
Sylvia, speak into the microphone more.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like my word.
There is no, okay. Imagine you are walking down a long path and it is dark, dark and foggy. There are bumps and obstacles in the way. You cannot see clearly. You don't know what lies ahead. You wish that the fog would clear. You begin to think, how can I make it to the end of the path with negative thoughts pushing me further back? It is important to get to the light that you sense is ahead. What can I do to change things? Then you say, I will get through this. I will find my way. It may not seem like it now, but I will. As soon as you make that comment, the light begins to appear. You know that where there is light, there is hope. What a welcome sight. You know you can find your way now. No holding back as you proceed to the light. That is how I felt as I went through the different stages of separation and divorce. In my essay, I'll Go Where You Want Me to Go, I discussed briefly my divorce, the effects it had on my life, the questions it brought up, and my concerns for my children. Mary Jane Knight's August 1985 talk, After Divorce, Clearing the Hurdles, states that the general authorities of the church counsel us to turn to divorce only after all possibilities have been explored and exhausted. Sometimes divorce is the only way, but then it leads one to cope with the challenges. In the beginning, for me, there was heartache and pain, thoughts that I would never get through the situation. I mechanically went about doing chores, caring for my children, trying to interact with friends and colleagues, and trying not to show them too much the pain I felt. Today, I will discuss what I learned from this challenge and hope there is something to help someone going through the process, and also to help their friends who want to help them. One challenge is the words that are said that are hurtful and unsettling that can come from those who want to help. Unintentional or not, our words, actions, and deeds have a great impact on us for good or bad. I remember when I decided I would go to a professional counselor. I felt it would help me to find a way to put my marriage back together. My first session went okay, or so it seemed, for a while. I related my story, we conversed for a while, and then the therapist said, he's not coming back. These were words that I did not want to hear. Those four words were very hurtful. I did not understand. I made it through the rest of the session, but then I determined that I was not coming back. I went home and reflected on the session and realized that maybe there was something to those words. It was a jolt that I needed. And yes, I returned to the sessions. And as I gained more insight, I came out of the fog. This helped me to move on. So those words turned out to be for my good and helped me progress toward healing. In contrast, there are words that come from well-meaning friends and family that are not as helpful. They have good intentions but may not know how to say what to say and end up saying something that causes more pain and sorrow. Those words may set you back in the healing process. This is where you must use discernment. I had concerns about how the divorce would affect my children and concerns about being a single parent. Well, it is documented that children raised in a single parent home have a much greater risk for substance abuse, for sexual promiscuity, for poor school performance. As a single parent, I learned that I had the ability to lead and guide my children in the gospel and as to the right way to progress in life. I was determined that they would not be at risk to factors that would hold them back in life. It is important to show your children they are still part of a family, a unit. It takes a lot of work, and you must be dedicated to it, but it is worth it. So divorce is a personal issue. I have related my experiences. What I did may not be right for you. Each one must decide what works best for them and for their situation. After a series of processes, we learn and grow from our experiences. From my experiences, I offer some suggestions and hope these will be helpful concerning the process of separation and divorce. One, seek or encourage professional counseling. That was a big help to me, and I couldn't see any way else to get through it. Two, be sensitive to the feelings of your loved one. Do not be judgmental. Three, listen. Let them vent. Let them talk without giving advice, and particularly not trying to give legal advice. Console and support. Be committed. If you say that you're going to help someone that's going through divorce, be committed to helping them. Whether it's child care, getting rides, or what have you, they need to have that stability to know that there's someone there that cares and that they can count on. Five, find ways to distract and common interest. And for me in the beginning, a distraction was actually walks with my sister and my children on Saturday mornings. This helped to clear my head. It gave me time with them, time to catch up with my sister, and all that was most beneficial. Six, do not isolate or alienate, because the person is still the same person they were before the divorce happened, and they still need you there. They need to have the help. Don't need to kind of push them aside and just let them languish. Seven, allow time to grieve. And this is very important. We have a tendency when we're going through something critical as this that we're not as kind to ourselves. We need to be kind. We need to be gentle. Eight, after I went through counseling and all, I found a support group and joined that. And it was very uplifting and helpful to be with others who had a similar situation. And knew what I was kind of like, what I was going through, and this was very helpful. Nine, do not gossip about divorced people. That goes back to what I talked about, how the words hurt. These are words that are behind the back, but even those words can come out in an innocent conversation unintentionally, and that brings more pain. And then last, believe that you can heal. Most important, believing that you can heal. It can happen. Divorce is a painful course to take, but with the help from those who sincerely care and who are sensitive to your feelings, you can make it. And I am a witness that you can heal. Thank you.
I'm just going to hold this.
Is that okay?
I'm too tall.
Even the core's not tall enough.
My name is Camille Fairbanks, and I wrote the essay Divine Nature in Fresh Courage Take. However, my involvement with Fresh Courage Take started several years ago, not as an author, but as a proofreader, when Jamie asked me to review a series of essays she'd commissioned for a book on the Mormon woman's condition. I heartily agreed and devoured the essays as soon as I got them. I loved them so much that I actually forgot to proofread them and just read them and cried. When I did finish proofreading them, I told Jamie that as much as I had loved the essays, I was kind of sad that I didn't get to add my voice to the quorum of women she'd collected. But the manuscript was just about ready and I understood. Besides, I didn't really have anything to say. I just knew that I wanted to be a part of this. Many months later, one of the 12 authors of the group rescinded her essay for personal reasons, and Jamie emailed me, did I still want to be involved? I didn't even have to think about it. Yes, I said. Please, yes. By then, the spring of 2013, I had become pregnant for the first time. When I found out that I was pregnant, my first reaction was not joy or glee or even cautious excitement. It was terror. And my second emotion was guilt. See, growing up in a devout Mormon family, it was generally accepted that at some point in life I would get married and begin to reproduce. However, during those pivotal teenage years we all know and love, my life developed in such a way that led me to dread this idea, not only of pregnancy, childbirth, and motherhood, but of marriage and sex as well. Part of that had to do with what I learned in my Divine Nature classes in the Young Women program, although not all of it, certainly. However, because I was 26 and in a stable, committed relationship, and I had no socially acceptable reason not to feel joy or glee or even cautious excitement at the sight of that little plus sign, instead, I felt overwhelmed with guilt. I didn't even like admitting to people that I was pregnant because even random strangers were invariably more excited than I was. I felt I'd failed as a mother the moment I became one. So there I was, preparing to have a baby despite all earlier misgivings. As I faced the thing I'd molded my identity during my teenage years around swearing I would never do, the topic of my essay became clear. I needed to write about how I'd come to create this child, I, who swore it would never happen. I needed to write about what had changed to make that happen, and what was still holding me back from fully embracing it and loving my life. I needed to write about it, not just so I could contribute to this book, but so I could sort through my issues and move forward. I felt that if I continued burying my head in the sand, I would deliver my baby and completely check out from reality, probably ending up with a divorce and a social worker, and maybe even jail time. It sounds dramatic, but I just didn't know how I could possibly love that baby. And the guilt for pretending to love him, so nobody would think I was a bad mother, would drive me mad. So I wrote. I wrote my heart into that essay. I wrote my deepest fears that I hadn't admitted to anyone. I wrote about decade-old memories I buried long before. I wrote of my life the way it had been, and the way I pictured it could be, someday, if only I could let go of my deep-seated anxieties and embrace a new mindset. That new mindset included the following three areas. First, I had to stop judging myself and release myself from guilt. Second, I had to stop judging others and release them from shaming. Finally, I had to stop believing that everyone else was judging me. I'd like to talk about my journey through those steps today. So as I said, the first step was to stop judging myself and release myself from guilt. To do this, I learned about the distinction between productive and unproductive guilt. Productive guilt is just that, viewing our mistakes as a way to learn, according to therapist Jennifer Rooney White. Productive guilt can motivate us to make changes and improvements in our lives or relationships, and this is not necessarily a bad thing. For example, forgetting your mother's birthday, feeling guilty about that, can motivate you to send her a card and a gift card to dinner or something. That's not a bad kind of guilt. Unproductive guilt, on the other hand, can have adverse effects on our cognitive and spiritual well-being and keeps us from evolving in those areas, according to therapist Jennifer Finlayson-Fife. For example, another therapist and author, Judy Belmont, says that by dwelling on unproductive guilt, a person may become overly self-critical, experience low self-esteem, and doubt her self-worth. Hearing this was a light bulb moment for me. Overly self-critical? Low self-esteem? Doubting my self-worth? Check, check, check. All of those descriptions perfectly describe the early stages of my pregnancy-induced guilt. I shut down. I moped around the house feeling worthless and sad. I told myself what a terrible mother I would be right from the start, all because I wasn't feeling the right emotions. In other words, by giving unproductive guilt a place in my life, I became a walking antithesis of divine nature. When at last I realized that my guilt over not being excited for motherhood was actually unproductive guilt and not useful or even within my power to change, I was able to begin reasoning it away. Although this is certainly still a work in progress, several years of practice have made it fairly easy to identify and discard thoughts leading to unproductive guilt. By so doing, I have become more at peace with myself and consequently more in tune with my true divine nature, the very core of my soul, or as my mother would say, what makes me tick. The second step in embracing my new mindset was to stop judging others and release them from shaming. Unnecessary guilt for one's own perceived failings is a poison, and thrusting it upon others in the form of shaming, judging, and criticizing is just as toxic. Now, it's not my personality to go around looking at people and saying, you shouldn't be doing that with your infant or for whatever reason. I just don't openly judge people to their faces. But I am certainly I certainly can confess to an equally harmful behavior, which is the silent judging, the quiet self-congratulation for being more acceptable than any number of women for any number of reasons. Why do I do this? Or why did I used to do it? I'm not sure. Maybe I was just mean. Or maybe I felt overwhelmed by unproductive guilt myself, which I now know profits nothing and should be banished. Once I began working on that, it became easier to release others from my judgment. After I began to give myself the benefit of the doubt by banishing unproductive guilt, it became easier to grant the same leeway to others. How? I memorized the following affirmation. It's kind of like the 12-step program. Nobody is perfect. Conformity is not perfection. Non-conformity is not sin. In fact, it can be beautiful. I memorized that mantra. I used it. I said it daily, sometimes hourly, or whenever I needed to cut someone some slack, even if that someone was me. I'm not perfect at this step. I'm actually not perfect at any of these steps, but I am trying all the time, and as with the first step, I find myself loving others in a more godly way when I let go of judgment and simply accept them. By attempting to see others the way our heavenly parents must surely see them, I've learned so much more about divine nature than I ever did doing personal progress value projects. Now, I am not saying that personal progress is not a worthwhile program, because it is, but I do think the presentation of some values, especially in a classroom setting, could use some modification. I go into that in further detail in my essay. Finally, the last step in my quest toward understanding true divine nature was to stop thinking that everyone else was judging me, which, surprise, was a lot easier when I was no longer judging them. My husband and I have a great love of driving of home design, and one of our favorite pastimes is to drive through neighborhoods and look at cute houses. We like to stop if we see one that we really like and pick out the features of the house that we particularly like, something that we might want to do to our house someday. It's a lot of fun, and not to mention quite a cheap date, but it does present one problem. Sometimes I spot quaint houses that I'd like to drive by, but they are located on a cul-de-sac. And if he's driving, my husband will never turn down these streets. He feels uncomfortable and thinks that people living in the houses will see us driving slowly by and know exactly what we're doing. I always chuckle, as some of you did, because from my perspective, three things. A, nobody has time to sit by their windows waiting to judge random people driving by. B, if they do happen to see us going by and spare even a passing thought as to what we could possibly be doing, they're probably giving us the benefit of the doubt and assume that we're lost. And C, if they actually are onto us and they know exactly why we're driving slowly up and down their streets and consequently decide that we are giant losers, well, so what? Those three points are exactly what I now tell myself whenever I feel my old anxieties creep in about whether or not I'm being socioeconomically appropriate. A, nobody has time to walk around looking for someone to judge. I'm not doing it, and they're not either. B, if they do think that I'm looking or acting or smelling kind of weird, or they notice my toddler throwing a massive tantrum, they'll probably give me the benefit of the doubt and just assume I'm having one of those off days. And C, if they actually are looking at me, judging me, and deciding I'm a giant loser, well, so what? My personal definition of divine nature, the definition that really has nothing to do with gender roles or failures in the home, is all about finding the peace of the divine that I believe exists in every child of God. With that perspective, if someone is judging me without knowing the facts, I say again, so what? I know who I am, and I can respect myself even when some don't. I came to these conclusions while writing my essay for Fresh Courage Take that spring, and by choosing to believe the words I'd written, I eventually overcame most of my guilt and anxiety, and what I couldn't overcome, I learned to live with in a healthier way. I began to do mainly the things I wanted or felt impressed to do, not because anyone else said that I should, but simply because I wanted or felt impressed to do them. Now, over 2 years later, I can say the words that my teenage self never believed she would. I am a mother. I am a mother, and I love being a mother. I won't deny that it is difficult, and that many days the difficulties outweigh the joys. But for me, being a mother is more good than bad. So good that I'm doing it again at least once, and we're very much looking forward to meeting our next baby in a few months. But even more important than my life-changing appreciation for motherhood is this, that if I hadn't taken to it quite so well, or if I had chosen never to undertake it at all, I would still have merit in the world and in the eyes of my heavenly parents. I invite anyone interested in this topic to research it further after the conference, and even find professional help if necessary. I've posted links to the quotes I've referenced here, plus many more articles, podcasts, and books on my blog, which the URL, I think, is in the program, in an attempt to provide a good starting point for such a journey. You might find that unproductive guilt has been holding you back in ways you never understood. Only when I released myself from such guilt, only when I loved others in spite of their failings, perceived or real, did I begin to comprehend how my heavenly parents must surely feel about me. And that is the real value of divine nature.
You're lucky I'm last because I speak very quickly and I can say twice as many words in half the time. My name is Rachel Brown, and I'm the author of the essay Wounded in the book, which I hope you all get to read.
I'm speaking to the microphone.
Oh, is that better? Did you hear that noise? Okay. All right. And the Lord called his people Zion because they were of one heart and one mind. Growing up in the LDS church, I desperately wanted to be a part of that Zion. I love that I have been lucky enough to be born in the true church with a living prophet so that I never needed to be confused about religion or my purpose in this life. I love the missionary stories about softened hearts and bended knees. I love feeling that I was part of an ancient family on a hero's journey home to my father. I love studying the scriptures and finding little treasures of insight I felt sure had been planted there just for me. I remember being about 5 years old and sitting with my grandfather in church, standing to sing Called to Serve, when they used to stand to sing it. I stood on the bench next to him, held his hand, and sang out, "Called to know the richness of his blessing, sons and daughters, children of a king." I felt joy. I belonged there. Feeling I was of one heart with my fellow saints was always easy for me. Feeling that I was part of the one mind of Zion was much more challenging. I often felt I was out of step because I didn't and couldn't see things the same way others seemed to. My mind felt particularly out of sync when it came to issues of gender in the church, which I explore in detail in my essay for Fresh Courage Day. I wanted desperately to give my mind over to that one mind so much greater than I. The phrase, "my thoughts are not your thoughts," was a constant reminder that my own perspective was flawed, immature, and untrustworthy, and that when there was dissonance, I should always trust God, and therefore the men who spoke for him, more than I should trust myself. To reconcile my own divergence with this one mind of Zion, as I saw it, I assumed I needed to make my mind like everyone else's, the incongruence with my own leaders, with the leaders of the church who spoke for God. The strategy I used throughout my formative years and beyond is what is referred to in psychology as splitting, also called black and white thinking or all or nothing thinking. Splitting is the failure in a person's thinking to bring together both positive and negative qualities into a cohesive, realistic whole. It is a lens through which stimuli is interpreted as all good or all bad, with no middle ground or gray areas. Church rhetoric sometimes appears to support this dichotomous thinking. There are certain phrases often repeated that offer only binary extremes, such as, "Be thou hot or cold, if thou art lukewarm, I will spew thee out of my mouth." There are save two churches only, the Church of the Lamb and the Church of the Devil. All men are free to choose liberty and eternal life, or death and captivity. Consider also comments such as President Hinckley's from his 2003 conference address titled Loyalty. Each of us, he said, has to face the matter. Either the church is true or it is a fraud. There is no middle ground. It is the church and kingdom of God or it is nothing. This type of language supports the idea that to be of one mind in Zion, you must accept that the only true and living church on the face of the earth is always right, and to be out of alignment with the church is to be wrong and therefore incongruent with God's will, which is sin and spiritual death, weakness to be overcome. Black and white thinking serves an evolutionary function of helping us discern between safety and danger. As evolving ancient humans, we had to decide quickly if something was going to kill us or not, so that we could escape or defend ourselves. There's not much room for nuance in fight or flight. I couldn't fight the church or flee from it, so I both fought and fled from myself. For example, when I was a sophomore in high school, it was the year we were supposed to read the Old Testament in seminary, so I read it. And I read a lot of scriptures that were hurtful to me, that felt misogynistic. And as I continued my study of the scriptures, I didn't know what to do with the disturbing feelings I would sometimes have when I was studying, because I knew that when I studied the scriptures, I was supposed to feel good and inspired and liken them unto me. DNC 32 was very difficult for me when I read that as a teenager. I was crushed at the cruelty of plural marriage and the language used in that section to force Emma to submit and accept the principle. And at the time, there was no room in my paradigm to question the scriptures themselves, much less the prophet Joseph Smith. The scriptures were true, therefore this was from God. This is what he wanted me to understand about myself and my role. My own mind was screaming something different from the one mind of Zion, as I believed it to be, and that part of my mind had to be silenced and then punished. When I felt badly when I was supposed to feel good, it was my fault. I must be too prideful or too foolish to understand. Another example, I have two brothers who came home early from their missions. According to my black and white perspective, aside from physical issues or medical issues, there was no good reason to not serve a mission. So, unfortunately, my adherence to the one mind of Zion left no room for me to be a genuinely supportive sister to my brothers. I never even asked them why they had come home. I just assumed that there couldn't be a good reason. When I was finally able to listen to their stories, I realized how alone they had been, and I was very ashamed. Another example, my companion and I once taught a beautiful family a discussion. They were active in their Christian religion. They studied the scriptures as a family, and I remember even when we taught them, they were all cuddling together on the couch. They were like a commercial for the church. We thought at the time, family, isn't it about time? And then when we left that night, I commented to my companion that it was difficult to see how a family like that was suffering without the gospel. She reprimanded me and reminded me that all are fallen, all are lost, and how tragic it would be for a family that beautiful to forfeit the blessing of being together for all eternity. My mind wanted to let me behold and appreciate this family in their context and not twist their story to represent deficits I honestly didn't see, but that was not consistent with the goals of the mission and one mind of Zion as I understood it at the time. I had to see any tradition, any family system is less meaningful, less worthwhile, and less happy than it could be if aligned with the gospel and LDS values. Perhaps the most grievous effect of my all-or-nothing thinking was that it stifled my natural sense of empathy and compassion for others and for myself. When confronted with stories of depression, self-loathing, anxiety, and even suicide that appeared to be connected to rigid and shaming cultural and theological messages, I resisted feeling empathy because to feel empathy was to acknowledge that the church or experiences within faithful participation could be painful for someone. This could not be possible. In order to be of one mind, I had to tell myself that these people were deceived or prideful or hard-hearted, and that my own self-loathing was justified because I was deceived, prideful, and hard-hearted. I had to see the church as a place of healing only, despite evidence to the contrary, even within my own life and family. And now I deeply regret the empathy I withheld from others and from myself in an attempt to be like the one mind I imagine. I've experienced a shift in cognition in recent years, which led to a shift in my faith and how I understood the gospel, and I do talk a little bit about that in my essay. I began to explore the gray areas I'd always tried to pretend didn't exist. The journey from a straight and narrow mind to a more expansive mind has been bittersweet and has changed my life completely. One of the realizations I came to during my transition is that I've been mistaken in my understanding of Zion being of one mind. If there is or is to be a Zion community, it will be comprised of many, many minds. Years ago, my grandfather shared this anonymous quote with me. As diamond dust makes other diamonds shine, so minds are polished bright by other minds. The Zion-like one mind, as I saw it, causes us to see differences as weaknesses instead of strengths. I believe there's benefit even in the process of friction and tension that can sometimes occur as we challenge each other. We polish each other by gaining growth and insight. The influence of many minds shapes us out of our singular realities and our black and white thinking and reminds us that no situation is dichotomous and no human being is one-dimensional. I've also begun to understand that even within the church and those actively participating, the one mind of Zion I had imagined in my adolescence does not exist. I had pictured the giant pulsating brain from A Wrinkle in Time that compels one's heart and lungs to follow its rhythm and causes the inhabitants of the planet it's on to move together with mechanistic synchronicity. But this is not accurate to the complexity of the human experience. American novelist Marilynne Robinson states, "Every single one of us is a little civilization built on the ruins of any number of preceding civilizations, with their own variant notions of what is beautiful and what is acceptable. We take fortuitous resemblances among us to be actual likeness, because those around us have also fallen heir to the same customs, trade in the same coin, acknowledge more or less the same notions of decency and sanity. But all that really just allows us to coexist with the untraversable, utterly vast spaces between us." Rather than creating a sense of loneliness, these thoughts fill me with awe that we humans are able to connect and share as much as we do. But I also feel a deep respect for those vast spaces between us and the private and intimate space that is the mind of every human being. Being of one mind in the sense that I thought I understood is an absurd impossibility. I'm reminded of the children's story, Horton Hears the Who, where an entire planet of people, the Whos, exist on a speck of dust. I imagine that in a fundamental sense, we're all existing on our own dust speck. I used to believe growing up that in our faith tradition, we're telling the only true story. but on each of those tiny specks of dust, each who is telling their own story, which is true. In Horton Hears a Who, the inhabitants of the tiny world are in danger and must convince others that they really do exist. Their elephant protector, Horton, tells them, "You've got to prove now that you really are there. So call a big meeting. Get everyone out. Make every who holler. Make every who shout." So almost everyone in Whoville begins to shout, "We are here! We are here! We are here!" But still no one but Horton can hear them. So the mayor searches Whoville until he finds a very small child named Jojo, who's playing with a yo-yo instead of helping the town make noise. The mayor carries him to the top of the highest tower, where Jojo lets out a loud yawp, at which point the book reads, "And that yawp, that one small extra yawp, put it over. Finally, at last, from that speck on that clover, their voices were heard. They rang out clear and clean. And the elephant smiled. Do you see what I mean?" For me, my contribution to Fresh Courage Take was like my yawp bursting through the atmosphere on that dust speck. It represents the ownership and celebration of my mind. There's a powerful symbolism for me in this being the work that's been included in the book, because this essay is the first time I ever voiced these thoughts, the first time I ever claimed this piece of my own story. In a lot of ways, Zion cannot exist until the yawp is heard, and we recognize the other, honor our differences, and listen to the many minds who all have a valuable perspective to share. Fresh Courage Take absolutely accomplishes this. Thank you for listening to me and believing that I'm here on my desk spec, and I hope we can see other people on theirs and claim our own space as well, saying, "We are here, we are here, we are here."
Listening, and that there's a follow-up called "Mormon Women Sound the Barbaric Yelp." I think that would be a really good follow-up. It can't just be me. We went a little bit long, and I know that there's a conversation to be had in the Q&A, so I'm just going to, by a show of hands, ask you...
Who has cues?
If you would prefer that we just try to do a quick Q&A here, and get our questions out before we need to surrender this room, or if you would like to adjourn to Signature Books Station if you have books that you want to be signed, and if you're okay with asking your questions in the queue while folks sign them. So I see some head nods, but if you like the first idea of condensed, hands up. Nobody likes that idea, worst idea ever. If you would like to adjourn to the signature queue, Sound of Barbaric Yelp.
Yelp!
Excellent. Thank you so much. We'll see you over at Signature. And thank you, panelists.
Sorry,